call the meeting to order and let you know about the next hearing that we will be having. And that is on the finances of a walk-in program for hunting. And the reason we're doing it is because the bill is not in our committee. It was a late introduction and hasn't gone through policy, is my understanding. But the Senate has put a placeholder in its bill for, in its game and fish bill for a walk-in program. And that being the case, I think they're trying to negotiate something in conference committee. And because of that, I want members to understand the finances and the implications of the financing of that kind of program. So we will have, I've talked to Representative Packard this morning and told him we were going to hear the financing. We will also have a parallel discussion about and some information from DNR on the financing right now of the Game and Fish Fund, because that's the only source potentially of a walk-in program. Obviously, there's no general fund money. That isn't even something we can consider. But folks have said, let's raise the fees and have a walk-in program. So we're going to just do a walkthrough of the Game and Fish Fund, a walkthrough of the financing of a walk-in program, and see how much permits would have to be raised in order to do that. So just wanted to let you know, because I think there's going to be a lot of discussion about that, and it's best just to know what's going on ahead of time. Yes, Representative.
Is there a bill, Madam Chair? Or?
We will be doing an informational hearing. Representative Hackworth introduced the bill, but we do not have it. It's in the Game and Fish Committee, and it hasn't passed through the policy or come to us. The reason we're doing it is because it appears to me that it is going to go through the Senate and be passed on the Senate floor, and that will be a matter for conferring, and I don't want it to be a matter for conferring without us having a public hearing and having the public have an opportunity to weigh in, and folks who are interested in the Game and Fish Fund have an opportunity to weigh in. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you, Madam Chair. The other question would be, why have you identified the Game and Fish Fund as the only potential source of funding for such a program?
Well, it's not that I have particularly identified it. It is that the discussions I have heard from folks who are proponents are saying that what we could do is raise the hunting fee to pay for the new program. And that if you do that, it would go into the Game and Fish Fund. Now, we will have, I'm going to ask our House fiscal staff, Mr. Reinholz, if he will give us some initial introductions. Good to see Representative Dill here, because we're talking about the hearing on Tuesday on the financing of a walk-in program. And Representative Torkelson had asked why I, as part of the hearing, is going to have some discussion about the Game and Fish Fund. And my response was because in conversations with various people, they have identified a increase in the fee of hunting licenses as a way to pay for a walk-in program. If there's an increase in fees, it would go into the Game and Fish Fund. So does that make sense to you?
Well, I understand the logic behind it. Does it make sense to me? No.
Okay.
At this point in time, when we're seeing declining numbers in participation in outdoor activities, I don't know why we'd be thinking about raising those fees. And we have other funding available through the constitutional amendment or possibly LCCMR.
Well, for the constitutional amendment, I think it is, and I think it's good. I want us to have a few minutes on this, because if there are questions that need to be addressed, I'd like them to come up today so we can get them answered. But the constitutional amendment only allows for protection, restoration, and enhancement of wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat. So it would not allow for a walk-in program under that, under the constraints of the constitutional language. I think that's pretty strong.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, but I think it would depend on how that walk-in program was designed. If someone who signs up for the walk-in program agrees as being a participant in the program to maintain, establish, protect, preserve whatever habitat, it seems like it would be perfectly appropriate.
Well, I think then that's going to be part of our discussion on Tuesday. So let's. I will make sure that people have in their packet a copy of the constitutional amendment to look at. You can get a nice copy from Representative Murray. Any other information? You are indicating to me what I sense, that this was controversial, and so it'd be good to get some of these issues out on the table. So anybody else you would like to testify on Tuesday?
Mr. Chair, I wonder, is there some sort of, I think we should know what the Game and Fish Fund, how it's defined in statute. If we can get that for that meeting, would help me, because I'm not sure how that might dovetail with this.
I think that would be good. Perhaps we could ask council to just give us a brief introduction of the statutory part of Game and Fish on Tuesday, and then we will ask our fiscal analyst to give us a status of the fund right now. We'll ask DNR to talk about some of their projections, and I will talk to them before Tuesday. And Representative Hackforth is going to give us some information, and we will have an open mic for anybody who would like to testify about it. Does that feel comfortable for folks? Okay. I don't see any other questions on that. But then we will have two bills up two small bills up on Tuesday, too. And Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this hasn't got to do specifically with this committee yet, but there's a bill out there that I'm probably going to have a hearing on in my committee that I didn't anticipate, not to move it as a bill, but to look at it as a potential amendment to the Game and Fish when it gets to your committee, which I think is a week from today. Is that the tentative schedule?
We don't have a schedule yet.
But at some point, so I just want to let those people who are know it's the Hoppe bill. It has to do with restitution on the illegal taking and poaching of deer and increasing the fees, the fines, based on a scoring system, the antler scoring system, Boone and Crockett. And so rather than just bring it in and try and discuss it in your committee as an amendment, I thought what I would do is have a hearing just on that one item. And try and flesh that out and see where we're going with that, and then we can bring it in when we do the Game and Fish and talk it out. And I will communicate with you on that before that time.
I think it's always good when we can invite the public in to comment on some of these things before we take them. So with that, we'll invite PCA to come up and give us some indication or tell us about their enforcement activities. Members, one of the things that PCA has done has done a report that looks like this. I got a copy yesterday and have read it, not in total detail, but I have read it. And I want you all to get a copy so it will be in your folder. And this brings up to me a lot of the enforcement questions that I think we all have, and I wish we had it before this meeting, but nonetheless, we will have it afterward. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Smith. I'm the director of the Industrial Division at the MPCA. With me is Jeff Connell. He's the manager of the Compliance and Enforcement Section at the PCA. We're pleased to be here this morning. Thank you for the invitation. As a way to kind of get everybody up to speed as a basic level of understanding, we'd like to talk a little bit about kind of what drives the agency. We'd like to focus a little bit on the compliance and enforcement objectives of the agency's work. We'll talk a little bit about our enforcement tools. We'll discuss quickly our penalty calculation methodology. And then we'll get into sort of a program-by-program media area, if you will, discussion about the way that we measure the efficiency and the effectiveness of our compliance and enforcement programs, both in terms of outputs. Those are the sort of the standard compliance rates, those sorts of things, as well as the outcomes, the environmental impact that we believe our programs are having.
If you could just, for a moment,
sure.
It's that last issue that we would like you to concentrate on, the impact on the environment.
Okay. Then maybe I'll skip through some of the earlier slides, or I could touch on them briefly and decide if there's some additional conversations that might want to happen or might need to happen.
Fine, just make sure that we're concentrating on that one.
That is, most of our slides are focused on those areas. We were trying to get people sort of an understanding of the scope and magnitude of the agency's work, just so we could feel like people had when we were talking about the details, it would be helpful to understand that. So I'll try and quickly move past those items. Quickly, our compliance and enforcement objectives: protect human health and the environment is number one for us. Number two here on our list is encourage compliance using all of the tools. And the flip side of that is, of course, to deter non-compliance. And by tools, that is a broader reference to the sort of the three-legged stool of compliance and enforcement. And those three legs are education outreach, compliance determination, and then a good, strong enforcement program. We believe those three pieces are all critical for us to run an excellent and efficient regulatory program at the agency. Bullet number three is to create and maintain a level playing field throughout the regulated community, especially important these days as companies struggle financially and are looking for chances to expand and grow and come into build new facilities and communities. And finally, one of our overall objectives is to eliminate the economic benefit gained from non-compliance. In other words, a facility should not be able to make money while in non-compliance. Quickly, some of our enforcement tools that we use. This, as you move down the list, they become relatively more complicated. They're, as you move down, they become more associated with larger penalties, more serious non-compliance, those sorts of issues. So the first three here are what we call informal enforcement, and those are the conversations that we have, that our inspectors have regularly over the phone, during inspections, those sorts of events. Starting with notices of violation on down, those are the more formal enforcement actions. Things like field citations are our effort to issue essentially speeding ticket-like tickets to folks that are in non-compliance, used heavily in our tanks program. And as you move down that list, things like stipulation agreements are the more formal enforcement actions that include things like supplemental environmental projects, wherein a facility or a regulated party could agree to do some environmentally beneficial projects in lieu of paying a full penalty price. In other words, they can subsidize or take off a penalty amount and locate those funds back in the local community. Things like, for example, a diesel retrofit on a bus, dedicating some land for set aside for the community, things like that are pieces of a step, and that's part of a stipulation agreement. And then as you move down that list some more, consent orders are agreements that are entered into court. So we've got a court-backed system for the agreements that we reach. And finally, criminal action. The agency does not have its own criminal process. However, we do contribute and play with the counties and the cities and the feds on their criminal activities. Quickly, a couple of pictures, just so you get a feel for some of the things that we take enforcement action on. Here's a burn barrel that located in, I think, southwest Minnesota, burning solid waste. Here's an example of a company that was charging to take use fluorescent bulbs, and instead of properly disposing them, you can see that they were basically just dumped out back, and bulb material was all over the site. So again, expected to properly manage this material, this waste material, and instead was basically stored out back and outside. Here's quickly a improper disposal of e-waste. These are computer monitors and towers that were put into an old boat covered in chicken wire and sunk in Rice Lake up by St. Cloud, Minnesota. And this a contractor was responsible for this activity. And then here's an example of improperly worked BMP, best management practice, to control the discharge of contaminated stormwater to a river. You can see the delta on the other side of the silt fence. Obviously, the silt fence was not doing its job, and the result was significant silt and sand into the receiving river. And then finally, here's another example of a construction project that went wrong. A lot of silt and sand moving down a disposal way into a receiving water. I think this was a trout stream in southeastern Minnesota. Again, just some quick examples of the sorts of projects that we deal with on a regular basis that result in enforcement action. Quickly, how noncompliance is discovered. This is just a list of the ways that we discover or noncompliance items come to the agency. By a large majority, most of the compliance actions and noncompliance are discovered through submittal review. In other words, while it's file review information, they're required to submit to us monthly information, discharge monitoring reports, for instance, and emission standards. We'll review those, and if noncompliance is discovered, we'll take appropriate enforcement action. The other way we typically discover noncompliance is through our activities as inspectors, being out in the field doing routine inspections. Very quickly on how we calculate penalties. It is a gravity-based system, and the first part of that is the deviation from compliance or the severity. Here's some of the examples or some of the factors that we consider when we're doing that calculation. How long the violation went on, were there a number, how far above the limit, for instance, did those violations occur. Part two of the penalty calculation methodology is to determine the potential for impact, harm, actual or potential harm to the environment or the public. And the third part of our penalty calculation methodology is to determine economic benefit. And there's a couple of pieces there. Avoided costs and violation profits. Avoided costs, an example of that would be where the company should have installed a brand new piece of machinery, a control standard, upgraded a wastewater piece system, and did not do that and had violations. Another part of that might be where they exceeded a capacity for, and we'll talk about the ethanol facility in a bit, but for instance, they exceeded the limit on creating the cap on an ethanol facility. And the result was an emission levels above what they should have been allowed to discharge or emit. So now we're getting to Madam Chair, now we're getting to the meat of what we're here to talk about. First part we'll focus on is our hazardous waste area. The top line, the orange line, represents the number of inspections. This is all for calendar year 2009. The top line reflects the number of inspections conducted during that period. The blue indicates the number of enforcement actions and the types of enforcement actions. We went through these really quickly, but suffice to say that notices of violation are lower on the stipulation agreement scale and in terms of numbers as they would be. And then the bottom line in the green are the total number of penalties levied against the that particular industry or that sector in relation to the enforcement actions in blue.
So, missing your criteria of harm, the penalty, is that $171,000? You see that as the harm to the environment? Is that the message we're getting?
Yes, it's the potential for harm, and it's also the deviation from compliance. So if you're above your effluent limit or you're not storing material correctly, that would be, both of those things would be considered in that total penalty amount. Another output that we typically use is is our compliance rating. This is the number of facilities, the total universe of facilities, has waste in this case. The types of facilities are LQGs, low large quantity generators, small quantity generators, and very small quantity generators across the top. You'll see the target of our desired compliance rating, which is 90%. And you can see where they're actually sitting right now. This is a tool that we use across all of our media programs to determine how we're working. And it also tells us if, helps us to understand if we need to focus resources in other places. If we see a drop in compliance ratings across a certain sector or a certain subset of the hazardous waste generators, we one of our responses is to adjust staffing resources to deal with that that drop in compliance effectiveness. And just so you know, the significant compliance and the non-significant compliance on the left side of the screen are set up by the federal program. We're following the federal haz waste program. Non-significant compliance is what the feds call housekeeping violations. They're things like failing to update your safety manual. So for us, it's a little bit low priority because it does not link directly to environment and the things that are of kind of critical nature for us. So here is our shot at for the haz waste sector. Here is our effort to translate our compliance enforcement activities into purely environmental indicators. On the left-hand side, you see the pollutants of concern. And in the middle, you see our effort to understand if we reduced, prevented, or eliminated those parameters. And then the numbers reflect the pounds of pollutants that we have estimated that we have eliminated, reduced, or prevented. Now, I have to pause here for a second and just tell you that the difficulty that goes into this particular calculation. This is not done. Many states and EPA have made an effort to try and quantify this sort of data, this sort of information, and it has been very, very difficult. There's not a lot of guidance for us out there. We've been doing this for a couple of years in our programs, and we are certainly getting better at it, but in no way, shape, or form would I say that this is a hard and fast rule for communicating or translating enforcement data into environmental benefits. However, like I said, we are getting better at it, and we think it works well in conjunction with our other performance measures, our compliance ratings and the number of inspections and those sorts of pieces together tell a much better story. And so therefore, for us, it's one that we will continue to explore and get better at in the future. This does not tell you the deterrent effect that compliance enforcement has. It's sort of like understanding that an officer of the law, you know, giving a speeding ticket to a speeder has an effect in terms a deterrent effect on the community, but it's very difficult to quantify. Is it protecting the environment? Is it slowing people down? Absolutely. Is it easy to quantify what that number is? Not so easy. So for us, this is a process that we, I think, we're getting better at. We certainly are tracking as carefully as we can, and we think it tells a story along with our other more standard compliance enforcement measures.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if you could explain to me the difference between eliminating, preventing, and maybe a little bit about reduce, just if you took one of the examples like hazardous waste.
Sure.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, eliminating really is about taking out of the waste stream a pollutant that was existing and was having an actual, maybe an actual impact on the environment. So, for instance, it was an ongoing discharge of haz waste out of a tank, or haz waste that was identified in the groundwater or on the ground that we, because of enforcement action or inspection, were able to clean up and take off of the, take out of the system. The prevented and reduced categories are more about about potential impacts. So, for instance, in the tanks program, there are many tanks that are maybe abandoned or left, and they're basically uncontrolled. There might be some petroleum product left in the tanks, and they're not under cathodic protection any longer. We'll do an inspection, conduct enforcement, get the tank back under protection and operating correctly, and therefore, for us, that means we take that potential release that may have occurred sometime in the future and consider that as the pounds here. So we're translating that potential discharge of pollutants into a pounds number for this calculation.
And just a follow-up to that, so if that was a 10,000-gallon fuel tank, would that be calculated as a loss of the 10,000 gallons, or do you use some kind of an estimate of what the average loss on tanks of that size leak in a given year, or how would you do that?
Well, it would be, right, it would be if there's 10,000 gallons in there, for instance, and we did enforce, we discovered, we inspected, did enforcement action, that 10,000 gallons would be considered under the prevented. And again, it doesn't quite work the same way across all the media programs, because the way we measure prevented and reduced is a little different, but suffice to say, eliminated means actual discharges, pollutants in contact with the ground, or water, or being emitted into the air that are taken out of the waste stream. And prevented and reduced are about the potential pollutants that, because of an enforcement action, were taken out of the process, or handled correctly is another way to say that, managed correctly. Moving on to underground and above ground storage tanks. Again, it's the same format we saw with haz waste, the number of inspections in the orange on top, the number of enforcement actions in the blue in the middle. And again, the warning citations, these are the quick hits, the speeding tickets, so to speak, that work very well with our tanks program. That's why you'll see it with this group and not with others. A very effective tool in our mind. And then on the bottom are the penalty amounts collected over the calendar year in response to those enforcement actions.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. What does a petrol fund work for, and how effective is that as far as tank cleanup and stuff like that?
Madam Chair, members, maybe I'll let...
Or is that enforcement? Is it good for anything? I know we're still collecting it.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, I'm Jeff Connell. I'm the manager of compliance enforcement at the agency. The petrol fund doesn't play necessarily directly into compliance and enforcement. The petrol fund provides a reimbursement to gasoline station owners in particular that maybe have a historic spill. So it's actually used more as the carrot than the stick in this situation, because your petrol fund reimbursement can be affected by how cooperative you are and how quickly you do the cleanup and how thorough. But actually, us in enforcement don't have any connection to petrol fund. That's more of a cleanup related fund. And we have a program called the Leaking Underground Storage Tank Program that still receives petrol fund money and manages those sites that we identify when we do inspections, and we move them over to the cleanup program. And that's where the Petro Fund dollars are still being spent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I look at the Petro Fund's primarily already corrected all the existing used tanks in the state. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, what do you mean by used?
The ones that are already in use. The gas station is operating. It has a leaking tank. They have been corrected because they had the Petro Fund to fix it.
Madam Chair, Representative.
The primary numbers of tanks that are still there are ones that were in the ground that aren't being used. Abandoned, property sold, another owner of the property, and so forth. Is that a fair statement?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, it is, actually, because we are trying to get on an approximately three-year cycle for inspecting all of the underground storage tanks in Minnesota. By doing so, we're getting to a lot of those, and we're not having as many of the old, abandoned, unvisited tank sites anymore. So we've actually pushed the vast majority of these leaking tank sites into our cleanup program for Petro Fund. So really, the only ones that we find left, like you say, Representative, are ones that have been abandoned or, you know, from mothballed and shut down gas stations that haven't been seen in a long time.
Must be a lot of fuel oil heaters too.
Yeah, a lot of heating oil tanks as well.
Representative Coon has a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we've gone off into Petro Fund, just a quick question is, would that be a pot of money that could be used not just for gas stations, but say an old refinery site that was abandoned and discovered and somewhere, like New Brighton?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not going to speak as any kind of expert on Petro Fund, but no, my understanding is that for refineries, they don't qualify for Petro Fund, so they don't have that money available to them.
Representative Gunther? Yeah. Representative Knuth, I think primarily they use the redevelopment fund for that. It cleans up hazardous sites such as the lead site in St. Louis Park and the dump site in Andover and places like that. So there is a pot of money for that that is used very often. And it's the only way we can take contaminated sites and make them used for light industrial sites, etc.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question also has to do with the Petro Fund. And it is assuming that local units of government are eligible for Petro funds to assist in remediating a site. Does the department award Petro funds on the basis of an estimate for the cleanup up front? Or does the local unit of government apply for reimbursement after the fact, after the cleanup has begun or has been completed?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know for certain. What I do know is that the funds that they get for the cleanup are determined by the extent of the contamination and some environmental indicators in terms of the regulated or responsible party. The local government is going to get funds related to a reimbursement submitted after the fact. So hopefully
Thank
that
you.
Answers your question.
Thank you.
As we were discussing, we try to reflect a compliance rating with each of our programs, and for the tanks program, we're at a 67% compliance rate, which, by the way, we don't see the trends here, but is up substantially from 3 and 4 years ago.
So we believe we're having a market increase in terms of increased compliance rate based on our schedule to be out to inspect tanks on a three-year cycle. And then, again, here's the graph in that same format, trying to translate those compliance rating numbers into an environmental benefit. Again, the pollutants of concern, in this case paint and petroleum, are listed on the left, and the pounds by which we are estimating the benefit to are reflected there in orange, green, and blue. Moving on to water quality. Again, orange reflects the number of inspections conducted, blue number of enforcement actions and the type, and the penalty amounts are in green in the bottom. In this case, you'll see a SEP amount, which is Supplemental Environmental Project, again. Oftentimes, the water program and the air program lend themselves to better SEP sorts of projects because the penalties tend to be, we tend to have larger violations and larger penalties, and therefore offsetting that those penalty numbers by a SEP amount makes more sense for the regulated party. Our compliance rates for the water activities, again, meeting our standards and our compliance goals. These are, at the top of the screen, you see DMR compliance. These are the discharge monitoring reports submitted to us from permitted facilities every month. So this is the primary way that we keep track of and measure the effectiveness of permitted water, wastewater, and water facilities in the state. Again, our translation of those numbers into water quality environmental outcomes or benefits. Moving on to air quality.
Back on your slide, water quality benefits. The orange bar, the long one, is so small, but I think that is septic.
It is septic.
Would you want to tell us about that?
Madam Chair, members, the orange bar for eliminated under septic, the septic category, is about the elimination of discharges, bypasses, and straight pipes that were sending septage and sewage, misapplication of septage as well, directly to the environment. So again, this is sort of rubber hits the road translation. It's the taking out of these pollutants in the form of septage from either the water or land.
And so is this just industrial, or does this include household?
Madam Chair, members, this is septage regulated by the agency. So I think it certainly would include, while the counties regulate individual on-site sewage treatment systems, the state regulates the land application of septage, and we do have some larger, greater than 10,000 gallon per day systems that are regulated by it and are permitted by the agency. So those are the ones that we're talking about here.
Okay.
Not the individual on sites.
Okay, that's the point.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Air quality. Number of inspections along the top. Again, blue reflects the number of actions and the types. And the green represents the penalties and the associated SEPs. And for an overall compliance rating for the air program, we're sitting at about 88%, with our goal at being 90. And again, for the air program, our translation of those actions into environmental outcomes.
Representative
Ansel. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question has to do with mining. Mining activity has an incredible impact on air and water. Assuming that air and water permits are enforceable or are monitored, how would the department know after issuing a permit for a mining activity in northeastern Minnesota? I mean, how would the department know if the company that has gotten the permit is in compliance with the terms and conditions of those permits on a regular basis? How can the public be assured that the permit is being enforced and adhered to?
Madam Chair, Representative, there are a few ways that that we ensure that those things are occurring. The primary way, the ongoing way, is the for air and for water programs, they're required to do emissions monitoring, and for water they do. You recall the graph on DMRs. They're required to report to us on water discharge monitoring. In their permit, they are set and given a limit, and that is the limit that they must stay under. To exceed that limit is a violation of the permit, and they are subject to enforcement actions. To respond to that, the permit also requires that they do regular monitoring both on the air and the water side. For water, it's for the largest facilities, it's certainly weekly monitoring and sometimes daily monitoring. That information goes to a certified lab and is analyzed to a certified lab and then submitted to the agency on a monthly basis.
Okay.
So that is one way by which we are assured that they are meeting their permitted limits. Another way that we make sure that they are doing that is by doing regular inspections. And for the largest facilities, which are, the mining industry certainly is one of the largest facilities, we are out there at least annually, oftentimes more than that. We've got trained inspectors who work in the air and the water sectors, very experienced, highly trained, and are there to ensure that these facilities, beyond what we can see on paper through the emission standards and the DMRs, our inspectors are there to look for the things that you can't tell from the paperwork. So that's why the inspection part of our work is very, very important to us. It's the second leg, so to speak, of that stool I mentioned earlier. It's having a field presence, it's being out there, talking with the regulated community, inspecting what they're doing, and then providing feedback through inspection reports. And if we discover noncompliance, then we do follow-up enforcement action. The other way I'd say that the largest of the large facilities are held accountable for their actions is by the public. We know that the largest facilities typically have a lot of people. If they're anywhere near residential areas, they get a lot of interest and scrutiny from their neighbors. And for us, it's a great feedback mechanism because many neighbors and concerned citizens and groups feel very comfortable contacting the agency to essentially alert us that something isn't looking right, something doesn't feel right, something is of concern to them. And when that occurs, we take that job of responding to complaints very seriously, and we always do. So those three things, I think, are key pieces of trying to answer your question.
Very briefly, I don't want to monopolize all this, but thank you. The last part of your response was of particular interest to me. As you know, the iron ore formation is long from the southwest to the northeast, but narrow. And the communities are within a stone's throw of where the mining activity occurs. And I'm interested in how the department would evaluate itself or grade itself on the air and the water compliance, especially with regard to how close people live to where the mining activity is actually taking place. Would you care to just, is the department comfortable with its ability to safeguard the public, or not comfortable, or how would you respond to that?
Madam Chair, Representative, part of the place that we're talking about now is more about the limit setting process that occurs in the permitting process, I think, is what you're describing to me. Part of what happens during the issuance of an air permit is the assessment about the potential risk. It's called an ERA. It's a careful assessment of the potential risk based on the pollutants of concern, criteria pollutants and others, toxics, hazardous pollutants, that may impact humans. That is a part of almost every or nearly all of the largest projects, and certainly all the mining projects go through this a detailed ERA, a risk assessment, to determine what kind of impacts they may have. If they are determined to be above a certain threshold, which we consider a higher risk, it is our job to work with the regulated party, the mines in this case, to find ways to bring that down into acceptable health risk numbers. And so I'd say that it's a very active process, and one that involves, obviously, all permits that we issue, or nearly all, involve a very rigorous public notice process. So the ERA and the permit, and typically an EIS is also required for the largest facilities. And between those three processes, I think we do a very rigorous job of trying to assess the impacts, and we try to communicate that with the public and take their feedback.
Thank you.
Representative Ansel, could you say that a measure in Virginia would be a fair measure? I mean, if the air quality measure in Virginia would be a fair representation of the impact on the community?
As usual, you ask a good question. If you're referring to the community of Virginia,
yes.
Virginia is kind of at the epicenter of where much of the mining activity occurs, because frankly the largest of the taconite operations is located within a stone's throw of that community, as well as two other smaller ones. So yes, Virginia would be an excellent place to do monitoring.
The reason I ask that is, and I regret that I only got this last night and we didn't have this for the committee today. I'm going to bring up my question. I'll share it right away with you. Is one of the things that in this report is specifics on emissions of fine particulate matter? And the reason that fine particulate matter are such a concern is they're a huge driver of healthcare costs to us. I mean, huge. And so what is in this report is a response to a legislative question about looking not at the current standard for PM2, but looking at the health standard that the medical community said should be the standard. And if you look at that standard in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and there are two St. Paul measures and one Minneapolis, we're into the part where we're in the range where there are health impacts, and that means there are cost impacts. And so Virginia is done on here, and you can just look at the four pages in the back. But I'm, as Virginia looks pretty good compared to, from my just my eyeballing it there, compared to St. Paul and Minneapolis. And we've just heard about all these bad air days, which aren't even in this. What are your compliance actions that you will be taking to keep our health care costs down here? I mean, because even if you use the federal standard and not looking at the health base, we're still high, and there's still huge health impacts. So what's your plan of action here?
Madam Chair, members, I think it's important to note that the AIR program, the standards set by the AIR program, are set by federal law. They're federally mandated programs, and our authority lies only as far as those are given to us in terms of setting permit limits. So as far as the PM2.5,
we cannot have stricter standards, is what you're saying, than the federal government?
I think that we probably can, but it's a part that needs to be directed by the legislature and not by the agency. We certainly are able to and willing to enforce on regulations that are set and limits that are achieved, but as far as the agency goes, we are a reflection of the public's desire to protect air, water, and land. And so as far as that goes, our limit only extends so far. Now, I will say that part of our job as inspectors and permit writers and negotiators, as we try to understand the siting of a new facility or an expansion of an existing facility, is to try and mitigate the health concerns that many people have these days. I see that as part of our job, to get together with the community and with the companies and try to discover ways that we can implement things that may have otherwise not been required but can be negotiated and put into permits to further protect the public's health, and also to make it viable for a facility to operate and expand and grow in a community.
I think the use of the word health concerns is not the one I would want us to focus on right this minute. It's the health costs we all see health, but we don't have to talk about health costs going up. And we know that fine particulate matter is a driver of a lot of those. So the science is there. We're beyond the science, having to ask science, is this a problem? So if there is this average, or in St. Paul at two places, which are over, and in Minneapolis, then there are probably going to be hot spots too. I mean, you can't. That's the. We still have to look at the question of how we are going to protect the public's health to the point that we can drive down those health care costs. So how are we to get at that? I mean, I think we're going to have to be a little bit more specific here. How are we going to get at that issue?
Madam Chair, members, I'm not sure there's an easy answer in terms of the regulations that exist right now. We do know in the heaviest populated areas that PM2.5 is most influenced by mobile sources, automobiles and garden equipment, lawnmowers, and those sorts of things. Those are not regulated by the MPCA and are not heavily regulated by the federal government. Those are places where there is opportunity, I think, to make some changes. And that's why, as I said, part of the conversation that we like to have when we're talking about facilities, because that's where our authority lies, is facility-specific issues. We like to sometimes, if it's possible, to translate those sorts of facility-specific concepts into a broader conversation. In other words, what could the facility do to minimize other sources of PM2.5 or provide the public a chance to adjust their lifestyles, for instance? It's a chance for conversations to occur about truck traffic and the way that materials are delivered to a particular industry. But all those are very, while they're very good conversations, they're very difficult to get at and to overcome on a purely regulatory side, the places that we have the most impact and have the tools to actually influence that.
Okay, well, I think this is the conversation that we're supposed to have today. I mean, that's why you're here. Representative, I think I've got three over here. Representative Knuth is first.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the answer on asking about air quality. And the Twin Cities is one of the few places that regularly meets federal air quality standards, is my understanding. So, which I don't necessarily know if it's because of what we're doing or the fact that we have good winds that blows it away to other places. But I think it's important for this committee to think about the impacts we have in, especially in our urban and suburban areas. I know we talk a lot about public lands and impacts in the northern part of the state and mining impacts, but I know I represent a district with huge freeway impacts, both in terms of noise and in terms of what's in the air, and also with kind of historic, I would say, legacy in a bad way, impacts of what's in the ground and water because of the way our city's developed. And I think we don't necessarily talk about those impacts directly in this committee, and I've been thinking a lot about kind of the middle suburban ring and the environmental issues we have there as a result of our freeways and where we put the bad stuff, so to speak, before we had these stronger environmental regulations and how we clean them up. And I appreciate your comment about redevelopment funds. I think it's underfunded in terms of actually getting it done. And I just want to remind members that there's different parts of the states having different impacts, and I think it's important to say that. We don't always say that in certain parts of the state, and I think freeways have huge impacts. Truck traffic has huge impacts, both on the immediate quality of life with noise and health costs long term. And I think that would be something really useful to talk about in this committee and try to find some solutions for. Basically, a suburban-urban livability surrounding our transportation infrastructure.
I would send this around. Unfortunately, we only have one copy, but look at the four back pages. Because I do challenge the fact that our air quality in the metro area is good. I mean, and one of the indicators is that the reason children in the suburbs as well as the city miss school the most is because of asthma, and that we know that their air is the issue, and fine particulate matter is the specific issue. So we're not doing the job yet. So we're going to have to figure out how to get it done. I mean, I like your measures. I think you're doing a good job in measuring. But the other measure of what goes on is how much we're paying in our health care costs. And that is a kind of a missing measure for us here. So with that, I think it Representative Gunther, you're next, and Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My question is, since Representative Anzo brought up living in Virginia area, Virginia, he said it was the epicenter of the mining industry. It's good to know that. Has there been any recent air quality alerts in Virginia like there has been in the city?
Madam Chair, members, I guess I'm not aware of the alert status, so I certainly can't recall if they've been. I assume it's for statewide when it occurs, but Mr. Connell, any sort of sense about that?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, I don't know of any that have happened any time recently.
Well, I don't know. Has there been any in greater Minnesota at all, anywhere?
Madam Chair, Representative, there has been alerts in Rochester, and I believe on occasion in Duluth as well, as well as the Metro. Yeah.
I look at what Representative Knuth said. I totally agree. I remember the reason that we started using a 10% blend of ethanol in the metro area only was because they were not consistently not following and passing the federal air quality standards. Magically, after they started using ethanol, they did. Amazing to me. And everybody says it's not worth my time. I remember going air emission testing station, sitting there for an hour and a half getting a citation saying I had to spend $190 fixing my car up then. And today I imagine that'd be $500. And I just looked at maybe the reason we're starting to have more is because, like Representative Knuth said, it is a problem with trucks and things that are increasing constantly. I kind of applaud the federal mandate that cars going to have better mileage. I'm surprised we hadn't done that 15 years ago. But I think that that should help. But it's good to know that there hasn't been any air emissions alerts in Virginia because I plan on going there or something.
Representative Clark is next.
I just wanted to check, and I have to apologize. I had an earlier meeting here, so I missed some of the initial testimony. But this last part that we've been talking about is very interesting to me, and I'm just wondering, either of you are working with or involved with the CAPE program over at the PCA, Community Air Improvement Program.
Madam Chair, Representative, I am not. I don't.
No.
No. My goodness. Well, Madam Chair, I wish you would. This is your organization, the Pollution Control Agency, right? Okay. Well, that particular program, I believe, received federal funds in order to look at some of the inner city air pollution problems and involve the community in assessing the ways to clean up some of the problems. We were talking about mobile sources of the tiny particulates that come out of traffic, for example, that really affect asthma and others. My understanding is that program is recently kind of not going forward, and I would like to know why. So if you could talk with me a little bit about that, I appreciate that, and check into it, because it is trying to measure and look at the issues in our inner city of the, you know, this is one of the places where we're out of compliance in high level and some of the alerts that have been coming up, and we have lots of children who are experiencing loss in school achievement because they're missing school because of asthma. I guess that's one thing. And then the second thing is, you know, representing an inner city community, one of the issues that we have to deal with is the what's called the cumulative health impact, the burden of one thing on top of another, on top of another, on top of another, when we talk about toxic exposure. And air pollution is, particularly again in this area of asthma, from those particulates, is in my district, is added on top of lead poisoning, arsenic, all other kinds of, numerous other kinds of issues that people are dealing with in their communities, mold in their housing, you know, just one thing after another after another. And so when we look at the cost to public health, I guess I'm just wondering, I have had some conversation with Mr. Thornton at your agency about this cumulative health impact. We actually have a law in place that's supposed to govern how you look at facilities that are proposed to come into, at least in areas close to the arsenic triangle in South Minneapolis, that they have to they have to go through an analysis to see whether or not they are adding to the cumulative health impact. And I'm just wondering if what you can share with the committee about that. Maybe we should ask Mr. Thornton to talk about it instead of you, but since this is coming up today around enforcement, I thought I would just see if you are on top of that or what's going on.
I think it would be good for you to have a response to Representative Clark, but send it to me and we'll get it to the whole committee rather than
okay.
If that's okay.
Yeah, unless they have something to say, updated, otherwise, sure.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have been, my division has been very active in the creation of the cumulative impacts analysis piece that we're charged to do. And so while, you know, Yolanda Hernandez and David Thornton have been involved more on the Cape side that you referenced earlier, our industry, our division is more focused on the industrial piece of that. And because that's so, we've been very involved with that cumulative impacts analysis. And I understand that we've got the design together for that. Again, this is a brand new system, not tested anywhere in the world, that the agency has been working on very diligently over the last few months. We think it's an important piece of the puzzle in terms of cumulative impacts and understanding the health risks that go along with that. And we will be, I think if you've not heard yet, we'll be approaching the community in the next month or so to have a kind of a public meeting and a roundtable to discuss how that process could work. So it's important to us because certainly protecting the human health of the Phelps neighborhood is important to us. And for the 13 to 18, I think, facilities that are located within that half-mile circumference, it's important that we finish that process up so that they can understand what is required for them to meet and expand, meet limits and expand and grow facilities. So those are all important pieces that need to be discussed, and so you'll see something from us within a month or so.
Okay, and maybe, Madam Chair, if I could just last comment, which is, and this is for the committee to know too, I mean, what's going on here is that we continue to have industries, including state agencies like the Metro Council, who want to come in and site facilities that would add to the human health burden. And so I'm grateful for the work that you're doing. I guess I'm very concerned about what's going on with CAPE, and maybe we can just talk some more about that later.
Representative Horton. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to highlight one of the things that Mr. Smith mentioned, and that is that with regard to air quality, the big issue is mobile sources. It's cars and trucks, and we've talked a lot about that. And we, Representative Gunther, did have a chance to adopt those standards a little earlier than the feds did. But there is a move in Washington to prevent states from having the right to control pollution from vehicles going forward. And I think as state legislators, we need to be very concerned about moves at the federal government to restrict our authority to do an even better job going forward. But I just want to note real quickly, as we were on this issue of the pounds of pollutants coming into the air and the issue of mobile sources, because we will have opportunities in future sessions to do more on the pollution that's coming from vehicles, and we'll have an opportunity to do more about helping our truckers retrofit their trucks to have auxiliary power units. Because, you know, whether they're driving or not, they're running their engine, because in the summer they need air conditioning, in the winter they need heat. And so it's just something we should keep in mind as we look at stationary sources and enforcement against stationary sources. Really, we have kind of an increased responsibility as legislators to do something about the mobile sources.
The document that's going around and the four graphs on the last four pages, for those of you who won't get a chance to see that right away, you should know that according to that information, the air quality in Virginia, Minnesota, on the Iron Range, is better than the air quality is in Duluth, Shakopee, St. Paul, Minneapolis, Rochester, not just by a little, but by a lot. One possible conclusion could be that northeastern Minnesota is further restricted by the federal government in something that is commonly referred to as the federal haze standard. And this may be a very, very good argument that regulation does work, that the standard is higher or lower depending upon your frame of reference, and the permitting agencies and the mining and paper proposers for permits can in fact comply. And so a possible conclusion is that regulation does work.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd add feedlots as well. You know, back in the 90s when there were a great deal of feedlots that were being built, you heard a lot of talk about hydrogen sulfide and air quality and water quality. And where agriculture, where we were concerned and upset, is some of the double standards that were in place as well. We purchased a drone meter, and I actually came up here with a friend and was doing air quality samples up here in the cities, and they were indeed out of compliance for hydrogen sulfide. We also rented some equipment from Atlanta, Georgia, that measured pollutants, and I got neighboring landowners around city lagoons in the springtime when they were turning over, and they were indeed out of compliance. And then every time you drove to the city in the spring, Le Sueur's city lagoons, and I think they're corrected now, I think they built something new, but they were always flooded and dumping raw sewage. I don't know if they're using them anymore. I called their representative, and dumping raw sewage right into the Minnesota River. And so there always appeared to be some double standards there. And you're talking about it being in compliance. There was a large feedlot in Renville County that was kind of the black eye of feedlot industry, if you will. The new company came in and purchased that, closed down some existing lagoons, basically made it more conducive for Minnesota climate, and worked with the Attorney General, Mike Hatch. And it was monitored 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for an entire year from the PCA, and not once was it out of compliance. And it just goes to show that regulations do work, like Representative Anzaux was saying, that these sites, whether they're the paper industry or the milling industry or feedlots, can indeed be in compliance.
It's wonderful to hear we're going to have some allies who are doing some regulation in the metro area where the health costs should be here the highest. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And this was, I actually raised my hand about half an hour ago. It was in relationship to the words that Representative Anzaux was telling us. And I'm just kind of curious, are the inspections, we're talking about inspections and enforcement, are the inspections of the regulated party, are they announced in advance? That would be one part of my question. And then the second part of my question is you talked about a private citizen giving you a tip off that something you should check, then do you have the right to go on private property to investigate a possible action?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative, we do most of our inspections unannounced, and that is, you know, sometimes a very difficult situation. We try to make our impact on the business as, you know, as minimal as possible. But we do want to get an accurate picture of the operation as it's in its kind of normal day-to-day mode. So we find that it's better for us if, you know, we're going to get that much better if we do an unannounced inspection. Sometimes they're announced if we need certain information to be present, if the opportunity for corrections is low and we don't feel there's a lot of risk from doing it announced, or we need certain key people to be there in order to get the information that we need. But the vast majority of the inspections that we do are unannounced.
and the second part of that was, then you do have the right to go on private property to investigate?
And Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we do. We, you know, our authority lies upon the proper presentation of our credentials, and then we have access to private property to do our work.
If you'll continue, I'm watching the talk, and I think you're just going to be able to get through this. And I didn't see anything here on enforcement with regard to water TMDLs. Is that coming in a separate paper?
It is not. Galen Reitz is here to discuss that if you have specific questions on the TMDL enforcement. Otherwise, we can certainly address general questions about.
We'll talk to him then. Let's let you finish.
Okay.
Did Representative Dilton have a
quick
question?
Well, no, I just had Representative Anzaux had a very good point. That class, that Hayes standard is, by and large because of the federal wilderness areas up in northeastern Minnesota. So I can only take from that that what we really need to do is to make Hennepin and Ramsey County into a first-class wilderness, and therefore we will have perfect air over this city, and we will no longer be suffering the ailments and such. And I think that all of the Metro members would want to support that and use bikes and canoes to get to work and
like
things
that.
Well, you couldn't use a bike because that's a mechanical device. Remember, you can't use oar locks to oar a canoe in the boundary water. So just remember that. There's a price to be paid for all of this. Clean air.
Well, I think if we clean up our air, you're going to have less of a problem. And maybe we need to find out something about the wind patterns. Because my guess is we're probably a problem. If you continue.
Yes.
Yeah, wait. I can wait.
Thank you. For purposes of just summarizing the data so far on outputs, total number of inspections, total number of cases, penalty amounts, and related SEPs. And then, again, a summary of all of that translated into environmental outcomes in terms of millions of, in this case, millions of pounds in the year 2009. I know there were some specific questions on the ethanol industry, and we thought we'd try to address those specifically here. I can move through these quickly if there are no questions, but for purposes of beginning the conversation, I think it's important to note that the ethanol industry is a sector that is still very important to the agency in terms of issuing permits and getting them facilities and the chance to operate and build and expand in Minnesota. Those are, have been and continue to be high priority projects for us. They represent jobs, and they represent, as we know, economic growth, especially for rural communities. So that's, it's important. It's an important sector for us to issue effective and efficient permits for. However, it's also important, like every other regulated community and regulated party in Minnesota, that they comply with the permit that they've agreed to. And so, therefore, it's when there is non-compliance with the ethanol facility or any facility, we will take appropriate action. Oftentimes, that's enforcement action to make sure that they are back in the compliance in an appropriate manner. So as a way to begin the conversation, unlike previous slides, we're giving you a snapshot over the last few years, essentially since 1999. And along the top are these sorts of enforcement actions issued to the ethanol community. There, by the way, there's 21 existing facilities currently. Along the bottom in blue are the number of enforcement actions summarized. So you can see the last few years there's been a trend up of enforcement actions against the ethanol industry. This next slide reflects the number and kinds of spills on the left side of the screen that the ethanol industry has experienced. Spills are, while not necessarily the cause for enforcement action, they do reflect for us the ability of a facility to properly manage their waste. And so if there's a number of spills, it would seem to indicate to us, it's an indicator that there might be some questions about their ability to manage and maintain their facilities. On the right, you see the number of complaints that we've received to the ethanol about the ethanol industry from community folks, from citizens, from other companies, from all those sources. Again, the takeaway from this slide is that there's been a lot of contact with the ethanol industry over the last few years, and the kinds of contact would reflect for us that there's a problem going on, and that it's a place where we need to get involved and try and correct kind of what's happening. This slide is to indicate.
Just hang on for one
second. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick questions. First of all, the top chart on that page, there were no actions taken in 2004 for ethanol enforcement. Is that because the state was broke in 2003 and we didn't give you any money, or just nothing bad happened that year? It seems kind of. Is that the reason, that there was simply no enforcement action, no money for enforcement? Or what happened that we have no actions in 2004?
Madam Chair, Representative, sometimes it's just the luck of the draw. I mean, there really isn't anything more scientific to say than that. Sometimes there are enforcement actions that actually started and were identified in 2004, but didn't get finished up until 2005, so they show up in the data the next year. So it doesn't necessarily mean that we weren't out there looking or that we didn't see a problem. It just means that nothing really got finalized in 2004. Short of that, the only other thing I remember about the time is which that's when a lot of new facility applications were coming in, and the agency was taking a heavy look at permitting and trying to get those facilities approved for construction.
Okay, and Madam Chair, the other question I have on one of the causes of ethanol spills you have is act of God. Who do you send the who do you send the fine to in that?
So moving on, we've got the types of enforcement actions on the left and the right are the number of penalties levied per year. And I draw your attention to 2009, when there was a large number of penalties and actions sent or issued against the 21 or a subset of the 21 ethanol facilities. By and large, by a vast majority, the money that you see reflected there is the result of economic benefit gained by the company during those times and because of those enforcement actions. In other words, while they were in violation of their permit, they were making an extraordinary amount of money, and when we levy penalties, and in this case, the specifics were that many of the ethanol facilities have production caps built into their permit. They cannot exceed so many gallons of ethanol per month or per year basis. But and to do so, they've accepted that limit because it restricted the amount of air emissions that were coming from the facility. Their choice was to exceed that cap. And the result was they made an extraordinary amount of money while exceeding the permit in that case. And so as one of our compliance enforcement objectives, as we talked about earlier, is to make sure that the companies do not come out financially ahead of the game because of the noncompliance. So most of those penalty monies in 2009 were the result of economic benefit gained by the companies.
Go ahead. I want you to finish up.
Okay. And then finally, just a comparison. Here is the air enforcement actions versus inspections. As you can see, in 2009, we did 180 inspections, and the result was 44 actions. And that is about the level that we expect. Maybe we're finding about a fifth or a fourth of the inspections that we conduct result in actions. In comparison, I draw your eye to 2009, when 15 inspections resulted in 16 enforcement actions. Again, would it seem to indicate that there's a trend of concern about the ability of these facilities to comply with their permit? The last thing I wanted to mention was an effort that we've recently begun. And this is one that we've used a number of times in the history of the agency when we've discovered sectors like the ethanol industry that were having trouble with compliance. It's back to the three-legged stool of outreach, assistance, compliance, determination, and enforcement. For us, we've decided that a approach that we are actively pursuing is the creation of an ethanol assistance team. These are three staff people working full-time for the period of 1 year to go out and work with these 21 facilities to get them back into compliance. It's not a forgiving process by which we forget the past and the history, or we forgive any ongoing violations. It is using all of the tools to try and get this facility back into compliance, and in the long run, it will be more cost beneficial to the agency in terms of cost staff savings than it would be to continue doing the high level of enforcement that's been our history for the last few years with this industry. We began this process in January of 2010, along with our partners at the Department of Agriculture, and we had a roundtable, a summit, if you will, with the ethanol industry, along with their consultants and attorneys. And our approach is to spend the next year providing things like detailed compliance and enforcement information, let them do self-audits, providing compliance feedback, and then being available to do inspections with them to test new processes, make sure they're keeping up with their housekeeping duties, and those sorts of things. So again, this is for us, this is using all the tools to try and get to our overall goal, which is maintain compliance and protect the environment and human health.
Good report. We are over time, but there are a couple of questions, and I would like to have Representative Lilly is gone, but Representative Gunter and Representative Hamilton have questions, and I think if you could answer those, that would be helpful.
Sure. I got one simple question. In one of these violations, is the Environmental Protection Agency the primary source of fines? Are they primarily investigating that violation, or is it the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency? Do you work together, or is one in charge of the project? How does that work?
Madam Chair, Representative, the agency is in charge of the projects. Only if we refer information to EPA do they typically get involved. They certainly can come in and do their own inspections and such, but they typically do not because of this. They're under the same sort of travel restrictions and budget constraints that the agency is. So I would describe the agency as being the lead in terms of compliance enforcement and inspections.
I was just wondering, I noticed in an ethanol plant in my district, the EPA's fine was 1/14th of what the civil penalty is from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Is that typical?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's difficult to measure typical, especially when it comes to EPA. That was a criminal fine levied by EPA, and oftentimes, while the criminal fines can often be very much higher, in this case, because of the specifics of the case, it was lower. And then we base our civil action on our standard, as you saw, our penalty calculation methodology.
Representative,
thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, what would the fine have been if they did not show a financial gain?
I'm sorry, you're talking across the board, or?
Well, you gave the example about the ethanol plant that had a violation. You based the fee on a financial gain. What would that fee or fine have been if they did not show a financial gain?
Madam Chair, Representative, without any specific case, it's about a fifth. About 80% of the penalty was related to what we call economic benefit from the violation itself.
And the violation itself was air quality violations?
Again, without any specific facility, they're generally water or air exceedances.
Okay.
And the economic benefit came mostly from overproduction of ethanol beyond the permitted limit. So if it was 49 million gallons a year facility, they produced maybe 54 million. And so if they had 5 million gallons of ethanol and an associated net profit from that 5 million gallons that we sought to recapture as part of the penalty for having gone past their permit limit. There is also, of course, with the 5 million gallon production, an associated release of additional pollutants that weren't allowed under the permit as well.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And along those lines, those air quality emissions that you just spoke about, they exceeded their permit in air regulation, along with their exceeding their permit in volume?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. Because their air limit and a lot of their water limits are based on that production limit. So their air limit is not necessarily a set number. It's based on, if you can only produce this many million gallons a year, we know that your air emissions can only be so much. But if you produce more ethanol, you're going to have more air emissions as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there's no relationship between efficiency or actual output. It's just based on your formula?
Madam Chair, Representative, on a case-by-case basis, if it's dealing with overproduction, we don't have continuous emission monitors telling us what's going out the stack every day of production. Sometimes we have enforcement situations with ethanol facilities that are based on performance test failures telling us that they were emitting more out the stack than they were allowed to. But the specific question related to economic benefit of overproduction was just based on how many gallons they made beyond what their permit allowed. And we may or may not have a test specific to that instance. We might just have to go with what each gallon means in terms of a release to the environment. Because we only make them test what goes out their stack maybe once or twice a year.
So perhaps we need to require continuous monitoring. You have one more thing you want to say?
No. Just the minutes.
Oh, just the minutes. Wonderful.
After careful analysis, I want the committee to know that I'm moving approval of the minutes of March 25th.
I see no questions. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Minutes are approved. Thank you. Thanks.